In the 19th century, the deadliest threat to European colonial ambition wasn't a rival army, it was a parasite, delivered on the wings of a mosquito. Malaria, grimly named the white man's grave, turned entire continents into no-go zones. But for those in the know, there was a lifeline, a chalky, throat-scraping powder that was bitter enough to make you wince, scraped from the bark of a tree growing half a world away in the Andes. I'm Megan Brame, and on this episode of The History of Plants, we're tracing the story of that tree, cinchona, and the potent chemical inside its bark, quinine. It's the tale of a miracle cure that saved millions from one of history's most relentless killers, and at the same time became a tool of empire that helped redraw the map of the modern world, from an indigenous remedy found in the Andean cloud forests to a catalyst for conquest. Cinchona and quinine's journey is part medical breakthrough, part colonial scandal, and fully entangled in the legacy of how we fight disease. But to understand how this bitter bark went from a local fever remedy to the backbone of empire, we have to leave the colonial battlefields behind and climb into the cool, mist-shrouded cloud forests of the Andes, where cinchona has been holding the secret to survival for centuries. Part 1. The Secrets of the Cloud Forest. Cinchona is a tree you've probably never seen, but its bite lingers in every sip of tonic water. Native to the high-altitude cloud forests of the Andes, stretching from Venezuela to Bolivia, cinchona thrives on steep volcanic slopes, shrouded in mist. Interestingly, the forests where it lives are above the mosquito line and are very cool, damp, and isolated. And it is here, in this improbable environment, that the tree developed one of the most chemically potent barks on Earth. Botanically speaking, cinchona belongs to the Rubiaceae family, the same one that gave us coffee. It's a genus of about 24 evergreen trees and large shrubs, all with leathery leaves and small tubular flowers. Fossil evidence suggests that the Rubiaceae family emerged sometime in the late Cretaceous or early Paleocene era, putting its origins at least 60 million years ago. While we don't have direct fossils of cinchona bark, its cousins have shown up in ancient leaf impressions from tropical South America, hinting at a really long evolutionary history intertwined with dense human ecosystems. But its most valuable feature lies under the surface, a tough grayish bark loaded with alkaloids. Quinine is one of the most famous of these alkaloids, but it's just one of many in cinchona's arsenal. These compounds obviously didn't evolve to treat human illnesses. They were actually originally designed, we think, to make the tree unpalatable to hungry herbivores and insect pests. It's an arms race millions of years in the making. Some studies even trace the botanical pathways for quinoline alkaloids, like quinine, back to early plant lineages, suggesting that chemical warfare was part of this family's strategy long before humans ever showed up with fevers and extractive ambitions. But of course, there's also the human history. Archaeological surveys in Peru and Bolivia have uncovered evidence of medicinal bark used by indigenous cultures centuries before European arrival. Among these communities, the cinchona tree had a sacred role. The Quechua people called it quinaquina, meaning bark of barks, and they used it to treat fevers and chills, grinding the bark and mixing it with water in a ritual that blended physical and spiritual healing. But this wasn't anecdotal trial and error. It was systemic ethnobotany passed down through generations. Other indigenous groups, like the Yanisha and Takana, also incorporated cinchona into their medical and ceremonial practices, often tying the plant's power to mountain spirits or protective ancestors. But what makes this so remarkable is that this tree's global fame would eventually hinge on a disease, malaria, that didn't even exist in these highland regions. The Anopheles mosquitoes that transmit malaria can't survive at these altitudes, which is so interesting if you think about it, because the original uses of cinchona were never about treating something like malaria. They were treating something else, fevers, chills, and perhaps altitude sickness or other endemic infections, maybe some that had malaria-like qualities but were not the same disease. It's just really kind of interesting when you think about it, about this thing that became so powerful to human evolution wasn't designed to do that at all. You know, like, crazy, getting back to it. For all their mastery of plant-based medicine, the Quechua and other Andean peoples didn't and couldn't know the true geopolitical gravity of what they called the quinaquina, because the most important thing about cinchona wasn't what it treated in their world, it was what it would come to treat in ours. And that realization wouldn't rise from within the Andes. It would have to travel. Part 2, a bad air. Malaria has stalked humanity for a millennia, long before we had a name for it. Caused by a microscopic parasite in the genus Plasmodium, the deadliest strain, Plasmodium falciparum, likely evolved in Africa alongside early humans. And as people migrated, cultivated land, and formed settlements, the disease spread with them, not carried by person to person, but by the bite of an infected Anopheles mosquito. This parasite has haunted every corner of human history, leaving behind a trail of feverish and icky, lack of a better phrase, breadcrumbs in everything from clay tablets to Greek tragedies. In Mesopotamia, we've found cuneiform tablets that describe cyclical fevers, which sound suspiciously familiar. In Egypt, modern testing has found traces of malaria in mummies over 3,000 years old. Indian texts from the Vedic period dubbed it as the king of diseases. Early Chinese medical texts offered a vivid and frankly terrifying explanation for what we now know as malaria. In the Neijing, one of the foundational works of traditional Chinese medicine, the illness was attributed not to parasites or to mosquitoes, but to three demons, and each one was responsible for a different aspect of the disease. One carried a hammer, delivering the pounding headaches. Another held a bucket of cold water, unleashing the bone-rattling chills. And the third wielded a stove for bringing on the relentless burning fevers. The art and the imagery of that, these three giant demon gods coming at you and giving you malaria? No, thank you, please. We think that malaria likely reached the Greco-Roman world sometime around the 1st century CE, traveling from the African rainforests northward along the Nile and into the Mediterranean basin. The Greeks and Romans called it febris, or fever, and believed it rose from stagnant marshy air, hence the origin of the word malaria, from the Italian mal aria, meaning bad air. Some even associated its seasonal return with the rise of Sirius, the dog star, which is visible in late summer and early fall when the Anopheles mosquitoes are at their peak. Greek poets like Homer and Aristophanes spoke of malaria in their seminal works, the Iliad and the Wasps, respectively. Aristotle, Plato, Sophocles, even Hippocrates documented malaria-like symptoms. In Hippocrates' treatise on airs, waters, and places, he writes, quote, "This disease is habitual to them, both in summer and in winter. And in addition, they are very subject to dropsies of a most fatal character. And in summer, dysenteries, diarrheas, and protracted quartan fevers frequently seize them." By the way, if this episode feels like the kind of history class you actually would have stayed awake for, now is the time to subscribe. As Greek influence spread from Greece to Italy, so did the parasite. Malaria took hold in the Roman countryside, particularly in the marshes surrounding the capital, where stagnant water gave mosquitoes ample room to multiply. Roman medical texts, like Celsus's De Medicina, recorded the fever's familiar cycles, while in Methodus Medendi, Galen described symptoms like chills, sweating, and swollen spleens. Though they interpreted the disease through the lens of humoral imbalance, their works show a growing awareness of its patterns and its persistence. Over time, the fever became a constant in the empire, draining energy, shaping infrastructure, and embedding itself in the rhythm of daily life. And as the Roman armies and merchants pushed northward, they brought malaria with them. The parasite found quite comfortable homes in the wetlands of France, the Netherlands, and the British Isles, clinging to the marshes that fringed each new frontier. By the Middle Ages, the disease had become a grim fixture in European life, especially in coastal regions and river valleys. In England, it came to be known as the ague, and you might know that term if you are a fan of Shakespeare, because the term shows up repeatedly in his plays, reflecting its ubiquity. In Henry IV, Part 2, Falstaff jests about it infecting youth, saying, quote, "Now the disease hath neither tongue nor teeth, and is one of the most infectious in this youth. He hath the ague." And in Macbeth, the titular character uses agues to curse his enemies. By the time the British Empire began its own colonial expansion centuries later after the Romans, malaria was already an old adversary, familiar, feared, and still without a cure. Because the trouble was, no one had figured out a way to stop it. Before quinine, treating malaria was a messy, gross, desperate affair. European medicine, still mired in the humoral theory, assumed that the disease stemmed from an imbalance of bodily fluids, usually bad bile or too much phlegm. To treat it, physicians would prescribe bloodletting, emetics, purgatives, and really bizarre tonics. Patients were given warm beer, vinegar compresses, rhubarb, powdered pearls, and even spiderwebs soaked in wine. In more mystical circles, amulets and incantations were very common at trying to treat malaria. If you were really unlucky, someone might stick a boiled toad around your neck to draw the fever out. Unsurprisingly, most people stayed sick. Prevention, too, was guesswork, but not entirely misguided. In Rome, public health officials organized massive efforts to drain marshes around the city, not because they understood that it was coming from mosquitoes, but because they believed the illness came from the bad air that rose from the swamps and the stagnant pools. And they weren't wrong, because fewer swamps means fewer mosquitoes. Marsh drainage became a standard government tactic for centuries to come, from ancient Greece to Napoleonic France to British campaigns in colonial India. But malaria wasn't just Europe's curse. It plagued people across the globe, and different cultures fought back with whatever remedies they had. In India, the traditional system of Ayurveda documented recurring fevers and recommended a variety of herbal treatments, some which actually worked. One standout was Artemisia annua, a feathery herb also known as sweet wormwood, a cousin to the wormwood which was used in absinthe. Centuries later, and thousands of miles away in China, the same plant actually appeared as a cure, but under a different name, Qinghao. In the 4th century CE, the Chinese physician Ga Hong recommended soaking Qinghao in cold water to extract its fever-fighting properties. This method sounded counterintuitive because if you look at folkloric medicine, it's often recommended to boil herbs or plants or whatever to extract their properties. But centuries later, modern science proved he was right, because boiling Qinghao destroyed the plant's most potent compound, artemisinin, now recognized as one of the most effective anti-malarial drugs ever discovered. Going southwest in sub-Saharan Africa, communities use the leaves and barks of local trees, including neem and fever bark, to treat the recurring fevers. Like all of our ancestors back then, these methods varied, and some were grounded in tradition, while others were trial and error. But regardless, they formed the backbone of practical medicine for centuries. Despite all of these global efforts, nothing worked reliably across the board. The disease kept spreading, and as global trade accelerated in the early modern period, malaria's reach exploded, traveling with sailors, soldiers, enslaved people, and settlers. Wherever you're going, malaria is coming too. By the time the European empires turned their gaze towards the tropics, malaria wasn't just a public health crisis. It was an invisible enemy that was frustratingly standing between the British Empire and the global expansion they craved. They were fighting a fever that wouldn't yield to faith, to force, or to folklore. And if the empire was going to win, it needed a cure. Part 3. The Secret Leaves the Mountain. The search for a cure didn't lead imperial powers deeper into the tropics or into the swamps where malaria thrived, but up into the mist-wrapped mountains of South America, where the fever never reached, but the cure already existed. It was the Jesuits that first arrived in the viceroyalty of Peru in 1568. Like most Spanish missions, theirs was equal parts religion and strategy. They quickly established schools and churches in Lima and Cusco, and then expanded into more remote Andean regions, places where the Spanish crown had little control. In the process, Jesuit missionaries came into close contact with indigenous communities like the Quechua and also the Aymara. They learned the local languages, studied healing practices, and, somewhere along the way, encountered a bark that stopped fevers in their tracks. They may not have known how it worked, but the important part is they recognized it did. By the early 1640s, powdered cinchona bark was being distributed through Jesuit networks, eventually making its way to Rome, where physicians began to use it to treat fevers. Soon it was appearing in apothecaries around Europe, powdered, packed in small wooden boxes, and prescribed for the intermittent fevers that had long plagued the continent. But not everyone thought it was so miraculous. It was controversial from the very start. Protestant countries like England and the Netherlands eyed the bark with suspicion, not because it was unfamiliar, but because it came with Catholic baggage. Was it a medicine, or was this just missionary trickery propaganda? Some refused to take it, but that was okay because others took it, and they got better. As people began to notice these curative properties, the bark's reputation grew, and so did demand. The Spanish knew they had something valuable on their hands, and they weren't eager to share. The cinchona tree itself only grew in the high-altitude forests of the Andes, and the Spanish crown began regulating who could access it, export it, or study it. But that didn't stop everyone. Smugglers and naturalists began sneaking it out anyways, camouflaged in cargo or mislabeled or passed hand to hand. Jesuits distributed it widely but often refused to explain exactly where it came from, protecting both their trade routes, their reputations as miracle workers, and perhaps, hopefully, the people that they were working with to get this bark. One of the most famous legends around this tree came from the Countess of Qinchang legend, which began circulating around this time. The story goes that the wife of the Viceroy of Peru had been cured by the bark and brought it back to Spain. It's a neat story and good for hot goss back then, I guess, but like most neat stories from colonial history, there's not much evidence to support it was true. Still, it stuck. And when Carl Linnaeus formalized the genus in 1742, he named it cinchona, giving the so-called Countess a legacy she never asked for, while erasing the many indigenous cultures that called it Kinakina who had known about the bark's power all along. By the 18th century, cinchona wasn't just a medicine. It was a mystery, a commodity, a guarded secret with enormous power. Just stop for a second and just think about the gravity of the situation, right? Like, if you had found, if your government had found a way to cure all cancers, how tightly would they control that? How much would they allow other people to take it from them? Maybe in today's modern societies, we're a little better with sharing medical data and information, but you still have to kind of think of, like, if COVID had been more like malaria than the fast-acting, deadly disease that it was, we might have seen a little more control over the vaccine than we did. But it's kind of hard to, you know, parallel modern medical ethics with empire building governmental policy. You know what I mean? But I still hope that kind of paints a picture for you on what we were dealing with here. Like the COVID vaccine, like cancer vaccines, like any sort of medical miracle, someone was bound to ask, what exactly makes it work? And the answer was in the bark's chemistry. And that's where things start to get bitter. Part four, the bitter cure. Like I said, quinine was never meant to save us. It would actually evolve to keep insects away from the tree. Tucked inside the bark of the cinchona tree is a suite of bitter alkaloids, natural chemical defenses meant to repel herbivores and pests. They're aggressive, complex, and notoriously sharp tasting. Among them, one compound would become famous, which is quinine. And its reputation and fame is justified because it works. And by the 1820s, European chemists have finally figured out why. Until then, cinchona bark had been used based on reputation after centuries of trial, error, and missionary distribution. But now, the bark was giving up its secrets. Quinine was isolated as the active ingredient breaking malaria's grip, not because it reduced fever, but because it attacked the parasite itself. Specifically, it interferes with how the parasite is able to digest hemoglobin, your red blood cell's oxygen-carrying proteins. As the parasite tries to feed, quinine chokes off its metabolic process, essentially poisoning the parasite from within. The result? Your fever breaks, the chills stop, the nightmare recedes, at least for a little while. Because it's not perfect. First off, quinine is intensely bitter. So bitter, in fact, that it became the benchmark for bitterness used in sensory science to define the upper limit of what the human tongue can tolerate. Even in trace amounts, it leaves a lingering metallic sharpness on the tongue. Interestingly, that bitterness would go on to shape the flavor of one of the most iconic drinks in colonial history. But we'll get to that. Quinine also has some pretty harsh side effects. In high doses, it can cause tinnitus, nausea, dizziness, and blurred vision. In rare cases, it leads to a condition called cinchonism, where the treatment starts to feel like the disease. Compared to malaria, people were willing to take the hit. Because now that quinine had been identified, it could be standardized, measured, dosed, and distributed far more reliably than with powdered bark. And that meant it could be processed into capsules or dissolved into sweetened water and used as a prophylactic by soldiers, colonists, and officials stationed deep in the tropics. And that made cinchona bark, not just the medicine, but the ability to cultivate and control it, one of the most strategically valuable assets in the 19th century. Part 5, the cinchona heist. Quinine might have cured the disease, but controlling the trees, that's what won the empire. Throughout the 18th and earliest 19th centuries, Spain had a near monopoly on the cinchona trees. As I mentioned, they grew only in the high-altitude forests of the Andes in what's now Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia. The Spanish crown guarded them like state secrets, and exporting seeds or seedlings was illegal. Anyone caught trying to smuggle cinchona out of Spanish-controlled territories could be arrested. Or worse, for European smugglers, worse often meant imprisonment, exile, or loss of status. But for indigenous guides or laborers who helped them, the consequences would be brutal. Forced relocation, violent retribution, even torture. The Spanish crown guarded its monopoly with full weight of colonial power, and unsurprisingly, that power wasn't applied equally. By the 1800s, both Britain and the Netherlands were running malaria-ridden empires across Asia and Africa, but neither had secure access to cinchona trees, so they felt it was time to act. The Dutch moved first, and they moved very strategically. In the 1850s, Eustace Hoskarl, a Dutch colonial officer and botanist, was sent to South America under the guise of a scientific expedition, but his real mission was to steal the trees. With help from local guides and some extremely well-paid bribes, he gathered seeds and seedlings from multiple cinchona species and smuggled them out of Peru. Once the seeds arrived, they were cultivated in the one place the Dutch controlled with the right altitude and climate, Java, in what is now Indonesia. And it worked spectacularly. By the turn of the 20th century, Java had not only broken the Spanish monopoly, but had outproduced it. The island became a global hub for quinine production, supplying over 90% of the world's quinine. The British wanted some too, though. They had launched a series of expeditions, including an infamous 1860 mission led by Sir Clements Markham, a geographer, explorer, and future president of the Royal Geographical Society. Disguised as a plant-collecting expedition, Markham slipped cinchona seeds out of Bolivia and smuggled them into British India, where they fueled a new wave of pharmaceutical control. Spain, of course, called it theft, while Britain and the Netherlands called it progress. For the next several decades, cinchona cultivation expanded across the world. The Dutch refined their growing and extraction techniques in Java, turning it into a pharmaceutical powerhouse. British plantations in India and Sri Lanka followed, though they never really matched the same scale as the Dutch. Speaking of, once those trees took root in India, British officers began taking a daily dose of quinine. But as we said, quinine isn't exactly delicious, so these soldiers needed a little help to make it somewhat bearable. Their solution was to mix it with sugar, lime, and a splash of gin. The result was the gin and tonic, a colonial workaround that turned into a global cocktail with a legacy far longer than the empire that spawned it. By the early 20th century, quinine was a fixture of colonial infrastructure. Governments used it to keep troops alive, protect settler populations, and secure territorial ambitions across malaria-ridden zones. It was also privatized. Pharmaceutical companies like Bayer and Merck began patenting purification techniques and competing for control of the global supply. But empires are fragile, and as war loomed over the horizon, so did disaster. In 1942, during World War II, Allied soldiers were dying, not from bullets, but from mosquito bites. Japan had taken Java, cutting off 90% of the world's quinine supply. That miracle bark was gone, and with it, the only reliable treatment for malaria. At that time, behind the scenes, the US and Germany had already begun working to synthesize quinine. And with Java cut off, the crisis accelerated a chemical arms race, leading to chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, lab-made substitutes that could be manufactured on demand, bypassing the tree entirely, which, if you think about it, is probably a good thing because it cut down on demand, thereby reducing the need to cut down cinchona trees on a wholesale scale. And while quinine didn't vanish, it was still used in certain cases, but its reign was essentially over. Part 6, From Empire to Endangered. For something that shaped centuries of medicine, trade, and war, cinchona tree doesn't get much fanfare today. It's not gone, though. Several species of cinchona still grow in the Andes, and some continue to be cultivated on a small scale in places like Indonesia and Congo for pharmaceutical use. Quinine hasn't been fully replaced. It remains a critical tool against certain strains of drug-resistant malaria and is sometimes used when modern antimalarials fail. And that's created a strange new problem. With synthetic alternatives now widespread, the global demand for cinchona cultivation has plummeted. And with it, so has conservation interest. Many wild cinchona species are now classified as vulnerable or endangered, not because they've been overharvested, but because they've been forgotten. Take Cinchona officinalis, the original species that set this whole saga in motion. It's been so heavily hybridized for cultivation that pure wild populations are actually very hard to find. Meanwhile, habitat loss, climate change, and lack of financial incentive to preserve the trees have pushed several species towards extinction. The success of synthetic quinine was a double-edged sword because it helped so many people, but it made the living tree we originally got it from seem obsolete, which is ironic because researchers now believe we've only scratched the surface in cinchona's medical chemistry. The bark contains dozens of alkaloids beyond quinine, many that are still poorly studied. And with antimicrobial resistance on the rise, there's renewed interest in re-examining traditional medicines as untapped pharmacological resources. But those rediscoveries can only happen if the trees are still around to study. The cinchona tree has changed the course of medicine, of war, and of empire, but today it's mostly just a footnote. However, If history teaches us anything, it's that no plant stays forgotten forever, especially if you're a plant nerd like we are here.
I'm Megan Brame. Thank you for joining me on another episode of The History of Plants. Jump into the commentary episode on Patreon, or if you're curious what came next in the world of medicinal plants, check out my episode on tea. It's the one with a 1,000-year head start and some very shady emperors. Until next time, greenies, stay curious and don't forget to flourish.